For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave with your hosts, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and special guest, Richard Reinch.
We are going to jump right in with our special guest. Coming back into the cave is Richard Reinch. He dared to come back. We're so grateful, actually. So Mark and I needed to bring him back in because we have some important questions to pose to our special guest.
You wanted me to take you out of the cave.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. Into the light.
Right.
Into the light. Now, if you've listened to the cave before, you may have caught a couple of previous interviews. Richard Reinch is with Liberty Fund. He's the editor of Liberty and Law Review, but he's also a competitor to and collaborator, I think might be another way to put it, because he has his own show, which is called Liberty and Law.
Liberty Law Talk.
Yeah. Liberty Law Talk, which is phenomenal. So if you like the Catholic Cave, definitely turn into that because he interviews some of the most fascinating, interesting people out there, and often we ride his coattails here in the Catholic Cave. So we really appreciate having him back in the cave because now we have some, I guess the theme today is to really kind of for us to talk about nationalism and Catholicism. And I thought by way of maybe context or a prelude into the conversation, your recent article in National Review made good use of Pope Benedict's Regensburg lecture. Now that's a seminal, was that 2006?
It was 2006, yes.
And so that comes up frequently in various, not just Catholic intellectual circles, but others, because of some of the themes that he brings up. So I thought maybe we could start, Richard, with that. Maybe tell us a little bit about what is the Regensburg lecture and why is it relevant? Maybe in particular, why is it relevant overall? But why in this conversation about nationalism and Catholicism, how might we bring that to bear?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back. I love the hour I've spent with you guys, two previous instances, and I look forward to this one. The Regensburg Address, it's interesting, 2006. You will recall, after Pope Benedict gave that, the sort of official line was that it was an anti-Islam address.
Well, because there's kind of a backlash to it, right?
There was a backlash. And there were riots in certain parts of the Middle East.
Wasn't there a,
there
a
was
nun
a Catholic
killed?
A Catholic nun was killed. I'm
Libya
misremembering
or?
The country. It was either Morocco or Algeria.
Yeah, that's right.
Was killed, and so that was sort of the official line. Pope Benedict wanted to pick on Islam. And, of course, if you read the Regensburg Address, that is really like the opening two paragraphs. And what he is really doing in there is he is setting the stage to think about, it, provocatively so, setting the stage to think about what happens when human beings dismiss reason. Or dismiss the very thing that makes us humans, rational animals. And we start to think that we
There's
actually...
There's Aristotle rolling over in his grave, right?
Yeah. and you start to think there's nothing actually there but what I fill it up with, you know,
right.
Through my own words, through my own thoughts, language. There's an interior dialogue, but there's no objective reality for me to discover with others and to know with others. And we forget, thinking back to the Walker Percy interview, what does conscience mean? To know with others.
Right.
So Pope Benedict brings up Islam because Islam has a problem. And it has a problem not entirely unrelated to one that certain aspects of the Reformation, of the Protestant Reformation, which is it conceives of God as pure will. And the God of pure will theoretically can order you to do anything. And so now
including evil or things that are contradictory.
Right. That's right. And so Puritanism has always had an answer to this, which is God is pure love and pure forgiveness, except for when he's wrathful, but leaving that aside, Islam's problem essentially is God could order you to do anything, and of course the Quran itself has a lot of passages that open up to certain interpretations of violence. And so there is something that those Islamic terrorists can actually point to in the Quran. And there are no resources of natural law, of reason to sort and to think through this. I mean, so the Bible has instances of violence, obviously, in the Old Testament, but we're also able to sort of put this all together in a coherent way, and to you know, not endorse violence, to endorse mercy and love, but to also endorse sort of natural law aspects of pursuits of, you know, human, you know, various human pursuits, science, politics, law, you know, all of these sorts of things. We can sort of make it all work. Islam has a problem because God is so utterly transcendent that the only way we're able to know him are through these commands and these willful commands that he gives us. And so Pope Benedict was just sort of pointing this out. But what his real target is us. And I think that's a theme throughout.
That's rarely mentioned, but I think you're spot on.
And you see this even in you know, the French novelist Michel Houellebecq, right? And I, you know, his novel Submission, which I read in one day, was fascinated by. I'm not, you know, there are a lot of problems with the novel in terms of sort of the graphic content, but that's also the theme in his writing. When, you know, in Submission, what he's writing about is, in France, there's an alliance between the socialist and an Islamic party to take over and control France and put down sort of a French Catholic right. In the novel, that's not entirely strange.
Far-fetched.
That should not sound too strange. It's set in the year right. 2020. But the point of his novel is France is so utterly corrupt. Again, and he's pointing to, we've lost who we are, lost what, sure. Who we are, history, our stories, et cetera, et cetera. We're the problem, Michel Houellebecq says. And that's Pope Benedict's thinking in the Regensburg dress. We're the problem. Why are we the problem? And it's sort of, he gets into the modern deformation of reason, both the scientific notion that science, administration, all of these, the experts, that they're the sovereign, they're the ones we look to. Alternatively, and we never really hash out this contradiction, truth all resides within me. It's all my
subjective.
It's all my autonomistic desires that make sense of who I am and my freedom and my choices. The problem is you can't talk about that with others, in a coherent, stable way, where we're all sort of getting somewhere together. You can't do it. And so, as one of the things I said in the National Review article is, it leads to either sort of the tyranny of the expert, sort of a manic terror as we sort of look to these people to shape us and guide us.
I think of like Thomas Sowell's book, Intellectuals in Society, Vision, really, where he really, really points out, or Conflict of Visions is another one, where again, he's pointing to these problems, you know, and this deference towards expertise. And he's and Sowell at least is kind of warning us, as I think you're pointing to that too, is deference to intellectuals is precarious, because they're not always going to get it right, and they seem to have their own agendas at times too.
And that, well, they never apply their own criteria to themselves. That's
right.
A huge problem. And so you've got that sort of potential for terror, but then you've got the opposite end, which is sort of a paralyzed fear. I said, which is, because ultimately, human beings struggle to make sense of who they are using their own resources, using just naked reason. If you exempt yourself from sort of this rich heritage of resources that we have as Americans, as part of Western civilization, part of the Christian West, part of Greek philosophy, when you cut yourself off from all of that,
our communities, I got to be me, right?
Well, doing it your way usually leads to sort of a deracinated human existence.
Well, it leads to a narcissism, you know, where our own identity is basically filled in by what we
staring
project
at
out.
Ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. So, and especially with social media, with a lot of the technology that's there now, it's easy to put ourselves in these bubbles where we're just kind of reflecting our own image of ourselves back and forth, and have really no reference to somebody else.
That's right.
Well, and I think that feeds into that kind of the word that keeps coming up again and again is anxiety, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. we have this kind of itchy internal anxiety, and there's no way to scratch it because we're completely isolated, and we put ourselves in a kind of straitjacket, and our nose itches, and we can't find the relief, or we can't reach it because we've sort of put ourselves in this precarious position of this radical autonomy that we've bought into this. I would say it's a lie about the human person, that we're completely autonomous and completely self-sufficient. Now, let's turn that into, though,
politics.
Let's turn into politics.
I was going to say, because it leads into what we were talking about last week, Tim, which is globalization.
Right.
That, you know, when you've got this identity that is pretty much boils down to just individuals, there's really nothing between the individual and some sort of universal belonging to humanity.
Well, I think there's problems. And Richard, you were just kind of pointing this out. There's this, it's a dichotomy, and it's a paradox, which is, on one hand, we're naked before the raw power of the state, which is dangerous, but at the same time, we have to keep giving the state more and more power and control as it in order for it to maximize my choosing,
and to preserve order, because of this immediate fallout of all of these various authorities losing ground, because we can't really make sense of family anymore, or why do we do civil society, why did we want to have basically a lot of private institutions, you know, people coming together for various pursuits, talking about really the American experience, why did we want to have all that, why did we want to have, you think about Republican government, really get into something I said in the piece, alluding to John Courtney Murray, the great American Jesuit who did theology, philosophy, and constitutional thought. You know, and what he said is, this is a moral enterprise we're locked into here as Americans, but we can only make sense of that if we can describe truth together and get somewhere together and build on a constitutional consensus, which helps us hang together even when we're really disagreeing with one another. And you can't do that. You can't do that with kind of where we are now. And so we do have this intense identity politics, and we also have an insistence on what's the government going to give me? What's it going to give me? And so as problematic as it is always to think about the common good, that's something we really can't even begin to do right now, other than to insist on, well, let's just give people a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Or let's have the state bestow upon you an identity, which you can then use as a trump card against your neighbor and various lawsuits, et cetera. So I think that's our immediate problem where we are now. The Catholic Church has an immense amount of resources in thinking about politics and the problem of nationalism, but also thinking coherently about nationalism, because the way in which we tend to think about it is sort of this pre-World War I attitude, which is sinful, and which is this idea that the government, the state, is going to fill me up and define all of existence for me. It's actually a pagan reincarnation.
Right. And, you know, patriotism is actually, it's a Catholic virtue, but it's very misunderstood. So I think you're right. It has been translated down into this idea of my state, uber alles, and, the state itself.
Were you just quoting Hegel?
I wasn't quoting Hegel.
I'm always on the lookout for you smuggling in Hegel.
Quite honestly, no. Unfortunately, that's the aftermath of Hegel that kind of distorted his thought there. But, patriotism, though, isn't that. It's a loyalty to place. It's a loyalty to family. It's a loyalty, I think, a much more local patriotism that's kind of the virtue that Catholicism's getting at. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's pick up talking a little bit about patriotism.
Great.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this. 40 Days for Life is a campaign of peaceful prayer vigils held at the site of abortion providers throughout the world with the goal of eliminating abortion. Here in Central Indiana, the Lenten 40 Days for Life campaign will run from Ash Wednesday, February 14th, through Palm Sunday, March 25th. Would you consider making this campaign a part of your Lenten observance? Go to 40daysindy.org for more information. That's 40daysindy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell. We have in studio with us Richard Reinsch, editor of Law and Liberty Journal. And also, you have a podcast, Law and Liberty Talk. So,
love that. Also, I'll tell you what, too, if you're looking to pick up an excellent book, your latest book, Seeking the Truth, an Orestes Bronson anthology, is outstanding. It's on Amazon, too, I noticed, which is great.
Yes.
To get it. Why patriotism? Let's go into that. First of all, maybe define patriotism for us a little bit. What notion there's maybe a lot of different concepts floating around out there, but when patriotism comes up, what should we be thinking of?
Well, I think as Roman Catholics, what we have to consider is the grace of Jesus Christ, which our church ministers to us through the sacraments, does not completely remove from us a natural love for our homeland and for our law and for protecting our neighbors, for working with them together in public pursuits. The church recognizes that as a good thing, and it actually comes from God. And the problem that we immediately run into is you got to reconcile two things: the universal church, and which is available to everyone, and so this thing that we're in, the church, which is a global institution, global calling, with a mediated existence of our country, of our political situation that we happen to find ourselves in. And the church recognizes that serving your country, loving your, defending your country. There was an encyclical that called Sapiense Christiane, Christian Wisdom, 1890. And one of the things it says is the willingness to die for your country is a good thing. And is actually, and the Pope says, this is expected from time to time. And so we have to sort of...
That sounds very foreign to our contemporary setting.
So we have to think about this. But the problem is, and by the way, the church has been concerned about and thinking about this question of politics and identity and loyalty, not just from the 19th or 18th century, sort of the age of nations, the rise of nations in Europe, after, say, the Peace of Westphalia, or after the French Revolution. It's been thinking about this problem from the beginning of its existence and writing about it. So we have to consider the Polish church, which is such a powerful example, and even now is sort of bringing up a lot of problems for the European Union. I think it's not coincidental that Poland is challenging the European Union.
Right.
That goes back to the High Middle Ages in the church, and the church's experience with sort of this unique country of Poland, and sort of recognizing its own national saints that arose. So, putting that all together, the problem is sort of this an aggressive mentality. It's an anti-Christian mentality that combined race, we're talking about blood and soil, that combined sort of this belief that, it's a pagan notion that instead of me as a person having a political existence, but then that political existence not ultimately defining the meaning of human life for me, which is ultimately caught up in Jesus Christ, it sort of becomes everything. And when that happens, it's I need to now marginalize other patriotisms, other countries, other forms of political existence. And that's sort of a nationalist aggression that is a part of World War One. And then you get in sort of this immense, when we get to Nazism and communism, sort of this immense heresies that begin to emerge in the 20th century. But the church has always recognized a certain relative autonomy to politics and to love for your country as a good thing. In fact, the best example of this is a 1937 encyclical Pope Pius XII wrote to Germany. And it's written to German Catholics and to the German Catholic Church 5 years after the Concordat the church had brokered with the Nazi government. And he is saying there is something good about your country. You received the gospel, and he's sort of recounting the Catholic history in Germany. Yeah. But now that is being shredded. The German Catholic Church's independence is being shredded in the name of the exaltation of a race, of a state, of a people. And he says that's pagan, that's anti-Christian. And unfortunately, all I can give you is Christ and your willingness to be a martyr. And that's essentially his message to the German people of burning concern is the name of the encyclical. And reading that, thinking about that in preparation for a lot of things I want to pursue coming up, it is a stark reminder that we can make this good thing an idol. We are not absolved from considering that. The question now is, are we in danger of doing that? But then also, I think we face, particularly the European situation, the European Union, I think, has very much sort of putting together a super state, which is meant against sort of the full record of the Christian witness of Europe's past. And that's a problem. And in fact, refusing to recognize that witness and its official documents. And that's, we don't think about that other problem enough. And maybe when we look to Hungary or Poland or the Czech Republic or Austria, these other nations, even I think inside France, we should consider what they're confronting, and maybe not just agree with sort of this official line that sort of there's these nationalist aggressive elements that are threatening the rights of peoples. It's much more complicated than that.
And it's a question that, you're right, goes back to, I mean, way even before the founding of Europe. I mean, you know, this is the question that Augustine was wrestling with City of God, mm-hmm. of, you know, where, what does patriotism mean? You know, where does a Christian's loyalty really fall? Do I have a duty to this pagan Roman Empire? Am I totally separate from it? And, you know, his answer is, it's a both and. You know, that you can be a good Christian. As a matter of fact, Christians make better citizens, you know, he said, than Roman subjects to a great extent. You know, America, though, you know, we can look to Poland, we can look to Hungary, we can look to these other nations that are kind of asserting themselves in the face of this, I think, aggressive push to kind of dissolve those national ties. America's a little bit different because we weren't founded as a sort of an ethnic nation.
No.
We were founded based off of an ideology. We were founded as a set of ideals, I guess a very liberal, democratic, intentionally liberal, liberal in the classical sense, country. And so it creates kind of a unique set of questions for Catholics of where does our loyalty to, I guess, furthering this sort of liberal project go versus where does our loyalty towards church teaching, towards which, I mean, a lot of times you think we're talking two different languages. You know, when you talk about, you know, our duty to church, virtue, you know, our duties to our communities, etc., versus our patriotic duty as Americans.
Well, I think, yeah. One question is liberalism itself as a part of the American experience. That's complicated. But I think, you know, the best liberalism at its best does not foreclose any loyalty or duty that a person thinks they have to their church. In fact, it opens you up to that and actually assumes that it is not the final word, but is trying to recognize and order a set of legal responsibilities, obligations, and protections for individuals and for communities against always this power of the state, and trying to limit it to something ultimately fundamental like a constitution. I think the unique part of the American experience for Roman Catholics, and which is why, you know, always coming back to Orestes Bronson, great essay he wrote, Union of Church and State. What he says is so unique about America is the most anti-papal people on earth, and I'm quoting him, who regarded the Catholic Church as, many of them did, as the whore of Babylon. Why is it that the Catholic Church is the freest in the United States of America? I mean, and Bronson catalogs historically, and he looks contemporaneously at the Catholic Church's situation, and he says, nowhere does the Catholic Church have a better situation than in the United States of America, this country which does have, in part, a natural rights philosophy. But Bronson says America, he argues, is a culmination, a distillation, when we really think about it, of sort of the full record of the Western tradition. And so it's building on that. It's not just an ideology. The Declaration of Independence is also coming out of the colonial experience of Republican self-government, people putting in common goods, thinking about how they want to govern themselves. And they're saying to themselves, you know, this relationship with Great Britain no longer works for a lot of reasons, and they give. And so really, I think the key part of the Declaration are the grievances, actually,
right,
which
right.
we don't read that. It's not just this second paragraph, which no, we all want to focus on.
Right,
but it's
right.
Actually, they're saying, we actually have this common law tradition, and you're violating it any number of ways.
Yeah,
all those grievances, by the way, make it into the Constitution. The second paragraph does not. So just put that aside. Thinking about our constitutional legacy, there is no contradiction ultimately between being Catholic and being an American. In fact, the Constitution, when you look at the First Amendment, so our Constitution is silent about God, and then we get the First Amendment, and there's not a silence about God. There's actually an assumption that religion is good, its free exercise should be protected, and it's allowing for citizens to do that, and the Catholic Church will walk in and fill an immense, I won't say a void, but we'll walk in and exploit this tremendous opportunity that it's been given. And so you actually see, I would argue, in the West today, there is no more physical, muscular presence that that the Catholic Church has than in the United States of America. And that's because I think this recognition, the best of America, is a recognition of religion being a good thing, but also patriotism being a good thing, but not really being fascistic about it, not really trying to enforce a set of claims, but they have emerged, and we recognize the goodness of our order, and we seek to defend it. Seriously, the French Catholic thinkers writing now, Pierre Menard, they all talk about America, and they're like, you are the nation state par excellence, and you're really the only country in the world that has such motivated citizens to do all the amazing things that you do. And curiously, he points to military. He thinks that's incredible, the amount of voluntary military service. He also talks about the death penalty, and that's an interesting thing, too, which maybe we can get into. But obviously very controversial. But
Pierre Menard, a believing
Roman Catholic. What he says the death penalty is, the death penalty is a recognition by a Republican political order that certain people, through heinous acts, no longer deserve its protection. And that in and of itself, he says, is a powerful statement of Republican loyalty.
Yeah, and Republican loyalty and also Republican virtue. And I think that's another area where America has kind of made itself compatible with Catholic tradition, Catholic thought, in that we've, from our founding, we've had this tradition of Republican virtues, of virtues of self-government, of coming together to hash out our problems, hash out our grievances, come up with solutions from a local level on up. Although, you know, I think there's some massive challenges we're faced with that, but yeah, the virtues that are instilled in America from its founding are very compatible with the virtues that the Catholic Church teaches regarding citizenship, regarding patriotism, and regarding our duty to our families, our communities, and ultimately our country.
Well, and I want to call that into – we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to bring that up as a question as to in our current setting, is that really still possible? Is that realistic that we can come together around these founding principles and ideals to address serious problems that we have now? So stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Cave. We'll be right back.
And we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
If you are suffering after abortion, you may feel very alone. You may have experienced abortion many years ago or a more recent abortion. Regardless of the circumstances, healing is possible. A Rachel's Vineyard retreat will be held March 9th through the 11th in the greater Indianapolis area for women and men who are seeking healing. To learn more or to register for this retreat, call 317-452-0054 or email projectrachel@archindy.org.
One day, one voice shared one message, and one man who provides one way to God. Maybe that's why we have one objective: share Jesus, the one who loves, saves, and forgives. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell, I think. So,
No, you have assumed a new identity.
Yeah. Correct.
And because who am I to say otherwise?
Exactly. You can be whoever you want to be, Tim.
Right. There's a lot. That's kind of what I wanted to come back to, which is there seems to be a lot of trouble, a lot of difficulty, a set of challenges about us pursuing, seeking the truth together, that there, whether or not there's objective reality. So let me turn the conversation towards something that we were just talking about before the break, which is let's talk about a policy. Let's talk about the death penalty. Let's talk about the principle of the death penalty. Why? Because that has come up in various philosophical, theological, Catholic circles, intellectual circles, about whether from the Holy Father on down, about whether or not the death penalty is necessary and really what's its purpose, and does it fulfill a purpose in the current, at least in the modern nation state, where we have access to prisons that are pretty reliable in terms of being able to house and contain really violent people. So why execute them?
Yeah, no, and I just to reiterate, Pierre Menard, one of probably the best writers I think, currently on the nation state, the history of the nation state, and also what's it do? What's it for? Why should we defend it? And he is faced now with, as a Frenchman, of these real challenges. In fact, he just wrote a book. His most recent one is on how France might reconcile itself with the Islamic immigration presence. And he says we cannot.
That's a real problem.
And he says
for them.
He says it really is. He says we can't back away from our French Republican heritage in any stretch, but we can also, and he's trying to find certain ways which we can compromise and certain ways which he says the French should not compromise. But in the course of some of his nation state writings, he's touched on the death penalty, and he's one of the puzzles he is why is it the case that, and now France, I would say, probably has the biggest army of all of the current European states, but that's not to say very little. Why is it the case that we can't field really a vigorous military presence and actually project power if we needed to? Why is that? Now, one obvious reason, which we were discussing, is America has Europe's back, and they all know that. But
yeah, we've got NATO. NATO's mostly an American.
Although, if you look at our national security strategy that was released by the Trump administration, and I think that's right, our concern now is Asia. It's really not the Middle East so much. It's really not Europe, except insofar as Russia. Were Russia to actually really try to invade the Baltic states, invade Poland, et cetera, then we would have a problem, and right. Europe would really need us. But I think their calculation is that's not likely, no, however Putin might saber rattle. So that and Manat, puzzling through this, touches on the death penalty. And he says, we have this Republican political order unwilling to say who is unworthy of our protection. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, France had the death penalty up until like the late 1970s. In fact, they were still using the guillotine up until the late 1970s.
That looks like a bad way to go.
I mean, this is, we think about sort of a turning of the page and, the times, all times right. are forgotten and all this. In Italy, you couldn't get a divorce until the late 1970s. Right. So, all this is so interesting. And he says, if you can't define who's unworthy, how do you define who's worthy, and how do you tell people what to die for? Right. And now we don't make that.
Or what to kill right. for.
We don't make that immediate connection. But if you think about it, this does start to filter out in the public conscience. What is this freedom for? What's it about? Right. And really they struggle for an answer. And then you get sort of, well, the European Union will just shift the problem up and make it one of transnational administration, free movement of people.
This
goods
is where
services,
Pope Francis goes
prosperity.
A lot.
This right. will sort of, this will all sort of work. Except for when it doesn't.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Pope Francis in this context good. Because I think the death penalty becomes a flashpoint where you really almost get two competing visions of Catholicism. You have a Catholicism where rights and responsibilities and obligations and duties and virtues kind of filter from the bottom up to a certain extent. And so, you've got families, from families, you've got communities, and there's a set of obligations that go. Ultimately, when you're talking about the death penalty, the reason the death penalty is there is because the state has an obligation to protect its citizens.
To protect the common good.
Exactly. And that involves war, right. that involves the death penalty, that involves a lot of kind of maybe ugly realities with it. On the flip side, you've got, I think, a transcendent version of Catholicism that kind of tries to say, well, honestly, Catholicism is to pull us above those loyalties and to pull humanity to a state where we no longer need these sort of cascading sets of obligations and duties one to another. We can transcend that, and our duty is to be kind of a light to all those around us, as almost sort of a transcendent universal Catholic being that's in the world but not of the world. And I see this conflict kind of growing, particularly in the writings of the Holy Father right now.
Well, I think, just to jump in here, I think it's, and I think we were just talking about this new book out with Ignatius Press on the death penalty by
Fazer.
Edward Fazer. Right.
Is it Fazer? And he has a co-author, I think his last name, Bissett.
Yeah.
And, one of the more critical reviews has actually come from a sort of a Catholic communitarian thinker. And I think the problem you're talking about, Mark, starts high, and is a radical overprivileging of grace over nature. And I think when we start to put the theological virtues and forgiveness and grace and say, but there's no natural virtues, or talking about what we began with, reason, there's no, you're not willing to accord sort of a relative autonomy to politics or economics, you know, or self-government, it all has to be something very high, you start to lose the balance. And so you're no longer conjugating republicanism. You're no longer conjugating rights with sort of the need to govern. You're just sort of assuming, as you alluded to, salvation. And that's all this is about. And so if that's salvation, then maybe we should have just a lot of forgiveness. Or why, you know, I think with Pope Francis, it's sort of like when he never talks about constitutionalism. He never talks about property rights. He never talks about the rule of law. He never talks about limited government. And I think, and I don't know if it's, has he actually read the Western political tradition? Is he conversant in it? Is this also a part of sort of, I think he's heavily formed by Peronist Argentinian right. political mm-hmm. tradition, which is the state is like this massive presence that is there to do a lot of things for people. And we forget Argentina, one of the wealthiest countries in the world before Peronism. Right. I think it was like the seventh wealthiest country right. in the world by 1922. And that's gone. And that's right. gone in part because of this Peronist tradition. So progress lost, right? And Pope Francis, I think, unfortunately, is heavily formed by this. And so he doesn't think about all of the good things that we have really developed working together, just using nature and reason to produce sort of a good state, you know, a good political order. And then he kind of jumps in with, you know, sort of an effulgent Christianity that loses the balance, I think, when he gets into these areas.
Well, it also, I think, is a segue into when you think about this relationship between nationalism and Catholicism, the theme of today's show. You know, let's talk a little bit about immigration, and let's talk a little bit about what it means to belong to a nation, and you know what's a reasonable posture to those who are not yet part of our community. And here I want to go, maybe Richard, kind of turn that question to you and maybe think about like Roger Scruton and how he's responded to, mm-hmm. to sort of that question about thinking not so much about the nation's, our national interest as this blood and soil, but rather it's almost like a householding, right? It's about think about your own household, think about your own neighborhood and, you know, our posture that we all really have in common about who we let in the front door and who we don't and under what terms, you know, that becomes a good idea.
Yeah, and of course we should make the distinction. I think the immigration problems that, say, the United Kingdom faces and Europe faces with in terms of Islamic immigration, and you're bringing a people wholly foreign to the Western tradition in so many ways, is a much different. It's a much more immediate and in many cases dangerous problem for obvious reasons than the one we're facing, right. which has primarily been since the end of the Cold War. I mean, that's when we got a lot of Central and Latin American immigration, Mexican immigration. But now, as I was reading yesterday, the largest immigrant group recently is coming from the Asian continent to America for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think the immigration we tend to think of and which fueled the 2016 election, Mexican immigration is actually, it cashes out to nil in terms of return, you know, entry and return. So, but I think, you know, with Scruton, it is a legacy of settlement, of history. And so when he thinks about England, which is an imperial kingdom, the monarch, she's the head of state of like 32 countries.
No, Richard, you bring up, I think, a very good distinction between American immigration and European immigration. And that is, I mean, even before the contemporary wave of immigrants, our immigration experience has been people, by and large, from the Western tradition that come from Christendom or come from countries that have been colonized or influenced by Christendom. I mean, even immigrants from Asia, the American experience, I think we lose sight of how much influence America had over China prior to World War II that continues to influence their culture, even despite Maoism and communism and all of that. There's still sort of a almost ingrained Americanism, even within China, that kind of, you know, sort of, I think, makes them a little bit more compatible coming to America than Islamic immigrants are going to Europe.
Well, and also, as you know, as to note the obvious, so a lot of people talk about this, we know how to bring immigrants in and really make them Americans, because being an American is a choice. Ultimately, it's you do make this choice, this election, really, to come over and be an American. And so we know how to do this, and we do it very well. The challenges now, I think, one is sort of the identity politics and this official attempt by progressives to use the state to sort of take newly arrived immigrants and form them into separate identities who are, you know, think of themselves in that capacity and not necessarily as Americans. That's one challenge I think we face. The second challenge is sort of losing faith in our own constitutional tradition and our own insistence upon you come here and you are now this new, you become a new political creature. You become an American. And that has to remain a part of the way we think about immigration, or we do lose the balance and it gets very ugly, I think.
Well, but I think that's the road we're on, though. I think to a large, or a large segment of our political setting here in America is about taking immigrants, whether legal or illegal, and trying to form them in, using identity politics, forming them into a kind of reliable voting bloc, and railing against the melting pot of becoming an American. Because there's a kind of shaming that comes. They'll point to, you know, shortcomings and other things in American history where, you know, we didn't live up to our ideals, and they'll say, "See, so it's an appeal to pluralism, it's an appeal to multiculturalism, that come to America however you want, legally or illegally, but remain sort of separate." Within, and I make that distinction between, and maybe you could speak to this, the difference between becoming a citizen or just simply remaining an inhabitant mm-hmm. within our borders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you see this notion of we'll bring people over and they'll, you know, maybe just have sort of a legitimacy to work, but they won't actually in time join us as Republican citizens. I think that's very problematic from the overall standpoint of our tradition. But this seems something kind of the right and the left kind of could cohere around or agree on. So yeah, that seems to me definitely problematic, because you introduce a whole class of people into your country who are separate in a way,
right?
And aren't actually fully responsible for what's going on. So that's loggerheads.
You're orientating them towards benefits, receiving benefits, without instilling them this notion of virtue, common good, but also a sense of duty and obligation towards others.
Well, right. We should also, I mean, it is the case, too, that the, and just to state maybe an obvious factor, but so many of the immigrants who have come over, say, in the last 30 years are incredibly hardworking, industrious. And there's a lot of evidence of assimilation, despite some, you know, one of the things that Peter Lawler said is, I think it depends upon where immigrants are going. If they're going to Southern California, I think it's a different story. Now, he taught at a college in Georgia, and he said, what I see amongst Mexican immigrants around me in Georgia is a much stronger desire to be an American. He rooted in some much more conservative setting. And there was this desire to sort of cross over much sooner to you know, Americanism. So I think, you know, point out the obvious. I think the important thing is, despite what we hear, and I think this is unfortunate, you hear it sometimes from Catholic bishops in America, you hear it from the Pope, any sovereign nation state is fully responsible and has every right to make a decision as to who it's going to let in and who it's going to keep out, and that being made on the basis of what it thinks it is good. It's good for it as a country. And I think sometimes we lose this. We lose this basic fact. Now, I'm not saying to be mean or to be ungenerous or all these sorts of things, but this is a basic fact of political existence, because who you let in will shape the country you become in the future. So it's incredibly important that you get it right.
Yeah, and I think there's a distinction there between our duties to our neighbors, our duties to our fellow citizens, and our duties to strangers. You know, we have a tremendous duty to hospitality. We have a tremendous duty to take care of others. But there is still that distinction between somebody who is a stranger versus somebody who is kind of one of us. And that's not foreign to Catholicism by any stretch. I mean, I think that that's kind of built into the framework. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion here about, I guess, sort of the boundaries of nationalism and what constitutes a nation and how Catholicism reacts to it.
And we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy
right after this.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then, below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y. Saturday became much the same as other days.
Saturday in the park.
Saturday is a different kind of day, so start it off right with Catholic Radio Indy's Saturday morning lineup. Forming Faithful Families at 9, I Choose Life at 9:30, Catholic Jukebox Indiana at 10, The Catholic Cave at 11, and two episodes of Faith in Action at noon. Every Saturday, starting at 9 on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, here with our special guest, Richard Reich. And we're talking primarily about nationalism, but before the break, we were talking about immigration. And, our bishops have given us a set of resources and a set of teachings that really allow us to extend hospitality. I think that's kind of the big emphasis on it. Sometimes what gets lost in there, I think, is the prerogative that we have as Americans to kind of set limitations on immigration, set criteria, kind of decide to a certain extent who it is that we're going to welcome in as citizens. And I'll toss this back to you, Richard. Has the church provided us with a set of resources to help us with that question?
And I think something I said earlier in the interview, the church has been wrestling with this question of your national patriotic identity and your Catholic identity almost from the beginning, and did this before the age of the modern nation state. So the answer is yes. And I think what might be interesting too for us is a lot of conscientious, devout Catholics in America and also in other countries feel sort of a division being put upon them by political authorities and feel sort of a pressure to conform or to forego their Catholic heritage. And so, I turn on my computer and it's like every day there's something coming out of our country or in Europe where Catholics are being told X, Y, and Z. And so if they're going to participate in a profession or something like this. And the church has addressed these instances. And there's a great letter coming on the heels of after the Kulturkampf, which is when the German national state was unifying and wanted to unify around a Protestant ethos. And so they were officially persecuting the Catholic Church. And the Pope addressed this in particular and talked about the good aspects of patriotic identity and the good aspects of Germany and how the Catholic Church can make those better, and at the same time offering why this attempt to subsume the Catholic Church or to bury it was wrong and faulty. And so he gives you something, a really rich, muscular patriotism in this letter, but also gives you something else, which is sort of an awareness of why a Catholic had to resist. So the church has really addressed sort of immense critical situations for Catholics and their identities with the state, but never sort of downplays or says, this is actually because this is bad or this is because patriotism is bad in and of itself. It never says that. I think the problem with the U.S. bishops, my ultimate concern, and I love Archbishop Gomez of Los Angeles, but he writes about immigration, and it's like he's not even attempting to conjugate it with political authority, or with the needs of public space, or with anything that concerns a country. And just to point out the obvious, there's right away a problem with our welfare state when you have sort of large immigration. They don't really think through these issues. It's sort of like anybody in the world should be able to come into America and because we're Christians. And so that's, or because you're Catholics, you should think this way. And that to me is a problem. But of course, That's nothing new. I think a lot of American Catholic bishops get confused sometimes and don't really deal with this full record of teaching that the church has.
Yeah, I think the church a lot of times, and, you know, I mentioned this before, I think there's a tension between seeing the church as a global Catholic church that wants to sort of ignore those distinctions between nationalities, between politics, etc., and treat us all as just one great big giant flock, versus an understanding of Catholicism that I think subsidiarity plays a much more, you know, prominent role in, and that is, no, we adhere to our nationalities, we have loyalties to place, we have loyalties to family, and, you know, the practice of our faith kind of stems from that on up. And, you know, at some point there's a tension there that gets created.
You have to make sense of the fact that we're embodied human beings, so we carry this body, we're local, we're limited. We are prone with faults, and yet we are needy and dependent. And so we have to sort of put things together with other people we're living with nearby and try and make a good social, political existence for ourselves. And that has to be recognized and affirmed ultimately. And that will bring with it membership and loyalty and certain loves and certain virtues. And you have to sort of put this all together somehow, and you can't minimize it or downplay it or say, oh, it's inevitably aggressive or atavistic or things. You can't do that.
Right. I think when you talk about, for me, Richard, when you're mentioning this, putting it all together, and I think that's maybe one of our biggest challenges, because on the one hand, as Mark was pointing out, we do as Catholics, we understand that we have a preferential privilege for the poor, and we ought to love our neighbor. And at the same time, we also have to put together, there's just real practical needs and concerns with whether through immigration, legal or illegal, because of things like, I mean, just things like from housing to health care to schools and education to language to understanding kind of common law, customs, culture, on and on. The list is large, and without sort of going into it eyes wide open with structure, process, planning, people are already vulnerable because of their status, become even more vulnerable because they're not able to access avenues of assimilation, and begin to what we all hope is that climb the ladder. Yeah. Of prosperity as to what? Reach your full potential to human flourishing. And by just, you know, kind of throwing the gates wide open, we risk not putting it all together. And I think that ultimately is unproductive and maybe unloving.
And we lose sight of how we've done immigration right.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And we no longer can understand that.
Yeah.
And I think that the Catholic Church provides us with a huge resource, and that is centering its social teaching around the notion of common good. And
family.
But you know, to have the common good, to have a sense of the common good, you have to have coherent communities. And to have those communities,
there you go.
You have to be able to kind of have a sense of kind of who is in and who's out. You know, who has a voice, who doesn't, who needs to be protected, who's marginalized, how do we need to incorporate them into the whole. But you still have to have that sense to a certain extent that there is a common that we can seek the good for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think here we're going to run out of time because this has been a fascinating show. So let me do this. Richard, tell us a little bit about changing the subject a little bit. Tell us a little bit about some of your current projects, how people can follow your work, stay in touch with you.
Yeah, no, so what I've been working on for many years, but has now come to fruition. Unfortunately, a great political theorist, a friend of mine, Peter Lawler, passed away almost a year ago. And we were working on a book for Kansas Press, A Constitution in Full, The Unwritten Foundation of American Liberty. And that is now in the hands of Kansas Press. So
awesome.
Hopefully it should be published sometime this year.
And, well, we'll bring you back on.
But my next project is I'm writing a lot on the nation state. So.
All right, very good.
That's fantastic. So folks want to follow your work, where would we go?
Reinsch84 on Twitter. That's my favorite Federalist paper. The Constitution is a Bill of Rights. So that's why I chose that. And Liberty Law Talk, which you can listen to on libertylawsite.org. That's the online journal I edit for Liberty Fund.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks again, Richard, for coming back into the Catholic Cave. It's been a fascinating conversation about Catholicism, nation states, immigration, death penalty. We covered a lot of territory, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think it's about time that we kind of dub Richard as an honorary caveman.
I agree. Yeah. Okay, oh, yeah. With that comes...
Does that come with beer and steak?
It does. And furry palms.
Right. Okay, exactly.
And that is all the time we have for The Catholic Cave. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.